From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the New York Times reported that the Bush administration was retiring the phrase war on terror in favor of a new moniker, the Global War Against Violent Extremism. We heard a prototype as early as 5 months ago. Donald Rumsfeld tried it out at a Pentagon briefing in February.
An overriding priority must be to ensure that commanders have the troops and the equipment that they need to prevail in the global struggle against extremism.
By June, one more word had been added to the slogan, violent. Here's General Richard Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, at a congressional hearing on June 23rd.
Iraq isn't just a battle in the struggle against violent extremism and al-Qaeda.
But before we turn to the new phrase, we thought we'd recall how we fixed on the old one. Soon after 9/11, we spoke to Stephen Sloan, author of the Historical Dictionary of Terrorism, who told us the word had quite a different meaning when it was first invoked.
It really appeared during the French Revolution, what was called the Great Terror, under Robespierre. What Robespierre did was focus on the emergence of state terrorism.
You mean terrorism committed by the regime?
That's right. The systematic use of terror to enforce compliance to the regime's dictates. Certainly the word, I think, has really become very significant. I would use, in the modern age, the Munich massacre as the beginning of modern terrorism.
By the Munich massacre, you mean an extremist group that targeted the Israeli wrestling team at the Munich Olympics.
That's exactly right. And the reason it became a defining moment, well, I think, was twofold. One, the terrorists were using, as their mode of operations, aircraft. In essence, they were delivery systems to launch attacks at an area far away from their disputed homeland. But secondly, and I think this is much more significant, the Munich massacre spread fear and intimidation to a global audience because through the medium of television, the perpetrators got their message across to a global audience. And I think that's what was particularly significant about it.
On Monday, General Myers told the National Press Club that he objected to the phrase war on terrorism to describe the current conflict, because it implies that soldiers are the solution. But terror, he said, isn't the enemy. Violent extremists are. Terror is just the method they use. Michael Scheuer worked in the CIA for 22 years. For three of them, he served as the chief of the agency's Osama bin Laden unit. Last year, under the pseudonym Anonymous, he published Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror. And he told us that, in his view, Myers is exactly right.
Somebody said once, a war against terrorism is like fighting a war against a dive bomber or a battleship. Terrorism is tactic.
How can you fight an enemy you can't or won't identify? He says the new phrase brings us a little closer, but only a little.
I think it injects a little bit of reality to the situation, although they remain politically correct because they're calling it violent extremism and not mentioning the word Islam. But generally, it is a recognition that the war, I think, is not going very well, and it's going to take a very long time to rectify the problem the government has gotten itself into.
When you say they're being politically correct in avoiding the word Islam, does that suggest you think the word should be in there somewhere?
Well, clearly, the violence that we're confronting as a country is being conducted by Islamic militants. Our political leaders seem to think that it's politically incorrect or racist to tell the American people the truth. I think that's why it was called the Global War on Terrorism to start with, so they could avoid using the word Islam.
But wouldn't they be able to charge us with waging a Christian or maybe a Judeo-Christian war against them?
They already do. They clearly see this as a religious war.
But we don't see it that way.
Well, that's why we're losing. The war has to do with the perception in the Islamic world that U.S. foreign policy toward Muslims is a threat to their survival. And the more we try to make that foreign policy successful, the more we grow the enemy, if you will.
So the subtitle of your book, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror, incorporates this very phrase that we've been talking about. And not to get too tautological about this, but do you think that part of the answer of why we're losing the war has to do with the phrase, the way the problem has been framed?
Yes, because I don't think we're really fighting terrorists. I'm not quite sure what word you would settle on. I was going to use Islamic insurgency in the title, but the publisher didn't think that that would sell very well, so we settled on war on terrorism.
So your publisher thought that the word terror was much more marketable than the phrase Islamic insurgency. Do you think that marketing consciousness is also what motivated the White House to use it so much?
Oh, I think so, because you associate the word terrorism with sort of a fellow who just likes to light a bomb and throw it into a gathering of people to kill them. It's much easier to rally the American people, for example, to defend their liberties, their lifestyle, and their freedom than to say, we're going to fight because we need oil from the Persian Gulf, and so your sons and daughters in the military may die in order to allow the royal family in Saudi Arabia to continue stealing most of the oil revenues from their citizens. Words are very important here.
I see you have no particular opinion about this. I have to wonder, how do you grade the American press in its reporting on terrorism and its causes? Are the journalists asking the right kinds of questions?
Oh, no. They buy the baloney about bin Laden not representing any significant portion of the Muslim world, that his philosophy is basically he likes to kill other people. And if you look at the evidence that is available, there's absolutely nothing to support that. He's a rational actor. I'm not sure if 10% of the journalists I've talked to have ever read anything that bin Laden has said. And the stuff is easily available. There's nothing you need that's classified.
So when you're saying that journalists are buying that baloney, what you're basically saying is that they've relied far too much on the White House to set the terms of the debate?
Yeah, I think it's easy. The president, of course, has a great moral authority in the country, no matter what party he is. And in addition, if you're going to understand what bin Laden is saying, it's long and torturous work. You know, there's probably 12 or 1,400 pages of his statements and speeches over the last decade. So if the president says, you know, he doesn't have any goals, he's an inhuman killer, well, you take that and run with it. I think, generally speaking, Muslim journalists have done a far better job of covering this war than American or Western journalists. We say these people hate freedom and they hate liberty, and they think our society is vile. The question I would ask was, if you make that argument, why does Europe and the United States have such a problem with immigration from the Islamic world? If our society was hated, would parents be bringing their children here? But I've never heard any politician confronted with that question.
And so, while we wait for somebody to pose that question, you think that exchanging the global war on terror for a global struggle against violent extremism is some baby step forward?
I think it's an improvement in the direction of truth, but how far we get along the road to truth is going to depend on people asking General Myers or his successor, General Pace, what the heck do they mean? If it's not terror and it's extremism, what's motivating the extremism? I think in terms of America's survival, rhetoric, public speaking, has to become much more precise and much more frank and honest. Right now, there is basically no discussion of the enemy in the United States and what motivates him. In order to really understand the seriousness of the threat posed by bin Laden, we would have to talk about our relationship with Israel. We'd have to talk about the foolishness of being dependent on fossil fuels 30 years after the oil embargo. We would have to confront the mockery of our own heritage that we practice by supporting police states across the Islamic world, in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia, in Algeria. And so our rhetoric has become kind of analysis by assertion rather than any kind of frank discussion that would encourage a substantive debate.
All right. Michael Scheuer, thank you very much.
You're welcome, ma'am.
Michael Scheuer is a 22-year veteran of the CIA and author of Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror.
This week, the U.S. Army 3rd Infantry Division found itself in the awkward position of explaining why two news releases about two separate terrorist attacks included the same defiant quotation from an unidentified Iraqi supposedly responding to the incidents. A release 1 week ago quotes the anonymous source as follows: "The terrorists are attacking the infrastructure, the ISF, and all of Iraq. They are enemies of humanity without religion or any sort of ethics. They have attacked my community today, and I will now take the fight to the terrorists." a July 13th release about a car bombing used that exact quotation, substituting only the word children for ISF, or Iraqi Security Forces. We wanted to get the story behind this astonishing coincidence, so joining me on the line from Baghdad is unidentified Iraqi. Mr. Iraqi, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you, sir.
I want to begin by asking you how all this happened, being quoted as uttering the identical words about two separate terrorist attacks.
The terrorists are attacking the infrastructure, the fill in the blank, and all of Iraq.
Understood. My question, though, is how you came to be speaking to the U.S. military in the first place. Are you yourself in the Iraqi government or the security forces?
Sir, they are enemies of humanity without religion or any sort of ethics.
Mr. Unidentified Iraqi, did you actually say the things that appeared in these press releases?
I will now take the fight to the terrorists.
Okay, forgive me for observing two things. One, your quotations were awfully convenient for an army battling not just insurgents, but also media portrayals of bitter and demoralized ordinary Iraqis. And two, that really sounds like a fake Iraqi accent. Can you offer one original thought that would make me believe you actually exist?
They hate our freedom?
That's not going to do it.
I think I've already given you my best material.
Mr. Unidentified Iraqi, thank you very much.
My pleasure, sir.
Unidentified Iraqi spoke to us on the phone from fill in the blank. Back in real life, the military did issue a statement regarding those coincidental quotes. Lieutenant Colonel Clifford Kent, spokesman for the U.S. Army's 3rd Infantry Division, said the use of the quote was an administrative error.
Coming up, all numbers are not created equal, and why the press gets foggy when the temperature rises.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. During British Prime Minister Tony Blair's June visit to the White House, he urged the wealthiest nations to double their aid to sub-Saharan Africa. President Bush resisted that pressure by reassuring Blair and the American people that the U.S. was already one step ahead.
America will continue to lead the world to meet our duty in helping the world's most vulnerable people. Over the past 4 years, we have tripled our assistance to sub-Saharan Africa.
Bush's statement signified a major commitment a month ahead of the G8 summit, which was slated to focus on Africa, and as such, his claim was widely reported.
He says the U.S. has, over 4 years, tripled its overall aid to Africa.
Mr. Bush said he'd tripled aid to Africa over 4 years.
So you are confident more money will be forthcoming, despite the fact that aid to Africa has tripled in the last 4 years to $3.2 billion, which is very significant.
But was it true? Susan Rice of the Brookings Institution crunched the numbers and discovered, well, no. Media Matters, a liberal media watchdog group, tracked how the press reported the president's misleading math. Media Matters senior advisor Jameson Fosser joins us now. Jameson, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot.
So first of all, can you explain what the president got wrong in his claim that the U.S. has tripled aid to Africa?
Sure. Basically, the Bush administration is claiming that aid to Africa has gone up from roughly $1 billion in 2000 to roughly $3 billion in 2004, which sure sounds a lot like a tripling. The problem is that they haven't released any details about where those numbers come from. The fact sheets that the State Department has put out just contain their own numbers. So Dr. Rice tried to look at it and find out where they came up with those numbers. And her analysis at least suggests that they're comparing basically developmental aid in 2000, which includes Children's Health and the Africa Bank and things like that, to a much broader category of aid in 2004 that includes not only that development aid but also military aid and disaster relief and things like that. And that strongly suggests that if you were to make an apples-to-apples comparison, I think the number Dr. Rice came up with was about a 60% increase rather than a tripling.
And you found, though, that many newspapers repeated the president's claim. USA Today did a few times, AP did a few times, The New York Times did a few times. Was there anything that struck you about the way this fact was repeated?
Well, a variety of papers got it wrong in a variety of ways. Some of them repeated what the Bush administration was claiming as though it were fact. They didn't even say the Bush administration claims. They just reported the Bush administration has tripled aid. Some others did present it as what the Bush administration was saying but didn't offer any attempt to get to the truth. And some presented sort of as a he said, she said. They said the Bush administration says they've tripled it, but critics say they haven't. The constant was that nobody really took the time to figure out who was right. One interesting thing was that several news organizations, including the Associated Press, reported in late June that Dr. Rice at the Brookings Institution had debunked these numbers. But then within a week, that same news organization, the Associated Press, was again reporting that the Bush administration said they've tripled funding without including any indication that that may not be true or that at least some people have taken issue with the numbers.
But do you see this misreporting as an example of bias or simply as an example of how much reporters are flummoxed by budget numbers?
Well, I don't really like the word bias, in part because when people hear it, especially in the context of news reporting, they tend to think ideological bias, and I don't think that's what's at play here. I think there are other biases that work, biases against looking into the details of complicated numbers. So I just say that we have seen consistent problem with news organizations taking particularly sort of budgetary numbers at face value and not looking into what's the truth.
You saw a lot of reporters getting this story wrong, but did you find any examples of reporters who did it right?
You know, we didn't.
Oh, no.
The closest we came, to be honest, was some reporters who offered some decent detail of Dr. Rice's study when it came out.
Can you give me an example of another numerically complex story that seems to have confounded reporters?
I'll give you an example of a numerically simple one. In 2002, you couldn't open the newspaper or turn on the television without seeing a report that the Bush administration was blaming the fact that the budget had gone into deficit on the terrorist attacks of September 11th. The problem is that in August of 2001, the government accounting office said that we went into deficit, and pretty much every major news organization in the country reported that. Several months later, the next year, you had the White House blaming the deficit on September 11th, and news organizations reporting that as though it was true. In fact, the bulk of the deficit was made up of the tax cuts.
So getting back to the Africa case for a moment, what do you think the impact of this kind of reporting is long term when it comes to aid for Africa?
Well, I think this plays into a misconception that a lot of people already have. For decades, polls and studies have shown that people consistently overrate how much money we spend on foreign aid. And so when you have an example like this of the Bush administration and a lot of media organizations telling people that, hey, look, we've tripled funding to Africa, and they already think we spend a lot more on foreign aid than we do, that's only going to serve to make a lot of people think that we don't need to spend any more, or maybe even we need to spend less. If that's the conclusion people come to based on the facts, so be it. But coming to that conclusion based on false information is problematic.
Jameson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jameson Fosser is a senior advisor for MediaMatters.com.
Journalists aren't confounded just by numbers. For 15 years, journalism professor Gary Switzer reported health news on television, and he says that's a beat that regularly takes a beating.
I would say that watching television health news today has actually become an unhealthy act. It's filled with one-sided, incomplete information. Lots of scares at one end of the spectrum, and then breakthroughs at the other end of the spectrum. But I think what I say is true for many stations, not all.
One of the big problems you identify is simple brevity. There's just not a lot of time devoted to a given story and to deliver it in the kind of context that it deserves, right?
45 seconds is the average length of a television health news story. We're not going to get much useful information in 45 seconds.
But your particular bête noire on all of this is simply the credentials of the people covering the news. I gather you think that a lot of the people out there doing that aren't simply not up to the task.
And I feel for them. I think many of them are thrown into this beat without any special training. They don't need a PhD. But it's almost as if we check at the door of covering health stories some of the basic journalism fundamentals that are applied in all other areas of journalism.
For example?
Single source stories are the rule, not the exception, in health news stories. Single source stories are a bad idea in any form of journalism. In health news, it's malpractice. There are so many vested conflicts of interest among the promulgators of health news and information today, it simply does not suffice to only have one source.
Now, you have proposed a solution for some of these problems. What is it?
Well, I'm glad you emphasized for some of these problems, because this would not be an answer to all. And I will admit up front that this can turn off a lot of journalists, but I want them to hear me out. I've proposed voluntary certification of only television health news reporters and journalists. These folks could go through certification whereby they would attend workshops or use online modules so that they could learn about how the FDA looks at new drugs. They could learn how to scrutinize claims and evaluate the quality of evidence presented by sources. They could learn more about the ethical quandaries that arise in health news, I think, more than in any other area of journalism.
Now, the moment you mention this kind of accreditation, journalists go nuts and say, whoa, this is veering awfully close to licensing of journalists. Play devil's advocate for a moment, please, and tell me why licensing is an idea that is so reflexively rejected by journalists, and then explain to me why this isn't tantamount to licensing.
Well, licensing generally falls into a regime of being mandatory. You aren't allowed to do your job unless you're licensed. And there are examples of government licensing. That's what makes that a very dangerous and a very bad idea, and that's why that's not what I'm talking about. Certification, on the other hand, generally connotes a voluntary mechanism. You can choose to do this if you want. You can choose not to. Certification tries to imply some standard of quality is met. It would not be foolproof, but it's better than where we are now.
And as you've pointed out in some of your pieces, it is not entirely unprecedented, is it?
It's not. It may be a stretch, but I don't think so within the world of television to take a look at what the American Meteorological Society does to certify broadcast meteorologists. You can go on the AMS website and find the now even more rigorous training that certified broadcast meteorologists have to go through to gain this certification. You know, I was at a Bob Dylan concert in town the other night. You may remember Dylan had a lyric from a song, "You don't need a weatherman to tell which way the wind blows," but television stations give more time to weather news and give more attention to the certification of these forecasters than they do to television health news reporters, from whom many Americans get most of their healthcare news and information.
Well, Gary, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the time.
Gary Schweitzer is the director of the Health Journalism Graduate Program at the University of Minnesota School of Journalism and Mass Communication. He worked in television medical news for 15 years. In most of the country, it was a real scorcher out there this week.
Across the Midwest today, the heat wave continues. Name your adjective. Stifling and oppressive come to mind.
It is a steam bath out there from coast to coast and almost everywhere in between.
An excessive heat warning remains in effect today for much of the Midwest.
As of Thursday, the heat had been blamed for at least 29 deaths in Phoenix, at least four in Missouri, two in New Jersey, two in Oklahoma, and one each in Kentucky, Ohio, and Mississippi. And it was far from the deadliest in recent times. 10 years ago this month, a pocket of hot air slowly baked the inhabitants of Chicago for a solid week, killing 739 people, more than twice the number who perished in the Great Chicago Fire of 1871. And yet that heat wave remains one of the most overlooked disasters in American history. Eric Kleinenberg is author of Heat Wave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago. His book examines why the media underplay the heat, even though it kills more people than all other natural disasters in the country combined. His case in point, that hellacious Chicago heat wave of 1995.
Really serious and dangerous heat was moving up from the southwest. In fact, thousands of chickens and cows had died as the heat wave moved its way up, and people had a sense that this was fairly serious. But there's a kind of standard format that journalists use when a heat wave arrives. They tend to go to an appliance store that's selling out of air conditioners and report on how difficult it is to find a new unit. They might do something like fry an egg on the street or do dueling meteorologists where they compare the heat in Chicago with the heat in Palm Springs. So we got that kind of light summer feature coverage for the first few days. Then it became quite clear that the heat wave of 95 was something special. The medical examiner's office began to report that tens and then hundreds in the city had perished and thousands more were hospitalized with heat-related illness. Suddenly, it wasn't such a light story anymore.
Well, I'm going to ask you about the casualty toll in a moment, but first I want to explore reasons that the heat wave didn't get the play in Chicago equivalent to, let's say, a hurricane bearing down on the Gulf Coast or a big blizzard in the Northeast. And one, I guess, is once the fried egg gag is taken care of, it's hard to take dramatic pictures of a heat wave.
Heat waves themselves are not so photogenic. I mean, if we compare an image of a heat wave to an image of a tornado or a hurricane or a flood, we realize quickly it's not that spectacular. And I think because the image isn't so powerful, they're silent and invisible and anonymous disasters.
Now, another reason you cite for undercoverage is the demographic profile of the victims, mainly elderly, mainly poor.
I spent several weeks talking to journalists in Chicago when I did research for the Heatwave book, and they made it clear that they wanted to tell a story of a disaster that made it seem as if it was a universal experience. If a blizzard hits Chicago, for example, everyone's affected by the pileup of snow. It's difficult to walk outside. It's difficult to move your car, get to work, take public transportation. But heat waves pinpoint this particular part of the population, the elderly, the poor, people living in relatively abandoned neighborhoods.
It pinpoints them, I'm sorry, because they simply don't have air conditioning, correct?
Exactly. They don't have air conditioning, and they're more likely to stay indoors and be isolated enough that they'll experience heat-related illness a long time and not have anyone come to take care of them. And so you definitely got in the Chicago coverage a lot of the debate between the medical examiner and the mayor, particularly a debate over whether the deaths were actually related to heat. But you didn't get a lot of reporting from the streets, from the neighborhoods where people were really affected by the weather.
As you said, Mayor Daley played down the seriousness of the heat wave, and he urged Chicagoans, quote, not to blow it out of proportion, and publicly cast doubt on the medical examiner's estimate of the numbers dying from the heat. And the press covered it exactly that way and became preoccupied with the politics of the story more than the life and death particulars.
This made for an incredible scandal, a kind of he said, she said story, where the medical examiner would have a press conference and then the mayor would have his. And unfortunately, the journalists in Chicago spent so much time covering this kind of strange political feud that they got distracted from the other issues, in some ways the more fundamental social issues, which concern the deep questions of why so many people were dying. And the other thing that happened is that that frame, the medical examiner versus the mayor, proved to be so journalistically compelling that newspapers and television stations stayed with it long after the scientific debate was decided. And so I saw in reviewing the coverage weeks later reports about this controversy, which in fact was not a controversy at all.
On this show, we've spent a fair amount of time criticizing coverage of weather stories and other natural disasters. But most of our criticism has focused on TV, especially cable news and local TV news. But in this case, according to your book, the print press had as much to answer for as anybody, and the Chicago Tribune seemed to acknowledge its shortcomings with an attempt, at least, of coverage after the fact. Tell me about that.
The newspapers in Chicago actually did do deeper coverage of the disaster than the local television stations. They didn't fail altogether, but they clearly didn't do the kind of job you would expect for a major American city. And some of the editors and reporters at the Tribune recognized this problem, and they went to their superiors immediately after the disaster and asked for permission to get some more people on the streets to do an investigative piece that would try to understand what are some lessons here. They put about 6 or 7 people on the job, and they spent weeks trying to come up with profiles of the people who died and died alone. But unfortunately, they didn't finish the reporting until the fall. And when the lead reporters brought the story to the main editors, they finally decided that actually 700 people dying in Chicago in a heat wave is a summer story. The editors insisted Chicago readers just wouldn't be interested in the disaster coverage months later.
From your perspective, having studied the Chicago disaster, what role should the media be playing during a heat wave?
In Chicago and in many other cities, local governments don't declare a heat emergency until local media begin to report that people are getting sick or dying. So they actually have quite a key role to play. If they would stop frying eggs, they could actually do terrific public health work.
All right. Well, Eric, thank you very much.
Let's hope we don't have to talk next summer.
Eric Kleinenberg is an associate professor of sociology at New York University and author of Heat Wave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago.
Coming up, an unaccustomed quiet follows the murder of a journalist in Haiti and a channel that shows another side of Africa.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Ever since Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was forced out of office in February of 2004, security in the Caribbean nation has steadily declined. Even with UN peacekeepers patrolling the streets, most of Port-au-Prince is controlled by armed gangs who've used Aristide's departure as an excuse for a campaign of terror. At least 600 people have died since last September, and over the last few months, random kidnappings have destabilized Port-au-Prince as a election season approaches. Most kidnappings end when a ransom is paid, but this was not true in the case of the popular Haitian journalist and poet Jacques Roche, who was kidnapped and killed earlier this month. As Michael Cavanaugh reports from Port-au-Prince, outrage over Roche's death has calmed the spasms of violence in the capital, at least for now.
On July 14th, the body of journalist Jacques Roche was found handcuffed and nearly naked on the busy streets of Port-au-Prince. Gary Azamar was one of Roche's editors at the newspaper Le Matin.
Il paraît qu'il aurait reçu 5 balles.
It appeared he'd received 5 bullets to his back. They'd broken his wrists and there were bruise marks all over his body, which was proof that he'd been savagely tortured.
By most accounts, at first, Roche was the victim of one of the random kidnappings for money that have plagued Haiti for the last few months. But because of his stature, Roche's kidnapping became big news. Originally, his kidnappers asked for a $250,000 ransom, as Roche's editor explains.
Les amis de Jacques n'avaient pas d'argent, vous imaginez bien.
We raised a small pot of money, and it seemed that the kidnappers agreed to accept that. But Thursday afternoon when I came in, someone asked, "Did you hear the news?" I said, "No, what happened?" Jacques was found dead this morning. To arrive one day and to hear that he was killed and the way that he was killed, it was like a cold shower.
Roche's death rocked a Haitian population that had become almost immune to random acts of violence since the forced departure of President Aristide a year and a half ago. Aristide supporters are widely suspected of supporting the killings and kidnappings, including the death of Roche. Some in Haiti suspect that Roche was eventually killed because he'd hosted a series of discussions on Haitian national television that included members of the Group of 184, the pro-business coalition that opposes Aristide's Lavalas party. But if Roche's murder was politically motivated, it seems the kidnappers were misguided in their choice of target. Roche was a staunchly independent journalist who was as beloved as he was difficult to pin down.
Maintenant,
this is one of the last broadcasts of Roche's nightly sports radio show on Radio Ibo. He was also a television personality and wrote on arts and culture for Le Matin. He spoke and wrote with passion about the environment, debt relief, and development, and was a highly regarded poet. The day of Roche's funeral was declared a national day of mourning by interim Prime Minister Gerard Latour II, who also suggested he'd name the street where Roche's body was found Jacques Roche Street. After the funeral, Haiti's main journalist association staged a march from the church to the National Palace. Jean-Paul Pierre, who worked with Roche at Radio Ibo, addressed the crowd at the end of the march.
We staged a demonstration to tell the authorities to take responsibility and to say no. To say no, this is unacceptable.
Jean-Paul Pierre has reason to be skeptical of Haitian authorities. Jacques Roche is far from the first journalist to be killed in Haiti in recent years, and because most of these cases are politically explosive, they languish, unresolved, in Haiti's ravaged judicial system. Roche's editor at Le Matin, Gary Azamar, is furious about the lack of justice.
Is there a country in the world that allows this kind of barbarity, these kinds of heartless things to happen while nothing is done about those who do it? And my anger is also directed at certain people who've got it in their head that killing people who've done nothing will achieve the result they want, because it won't.
It's an anger that many Haitians share. As if Roche's death were a wake-up call for all sides, security in Haiti has improved, says Azamar.
I'm
not saying it's good, but it's improved a great deal in the last month. But often after days of violence, there are 2 or 3 weeks of calm, and then it explodes again.
Frank Seguri, Roche's colleague and friend at Le Matin, worries that Roche's death will continue to be exploited by political opportunists, particularly anti-Aristide factions and the pro-business Group of 184.
I listened to many of the people talking before the day of the funeral, and that day, and in my opinion, Jacques Roche's memory was co-opted. I don't believe that the ideology of many of these people was the same as Jacques Roche's.
But at the same time, Seguri says,
I noticed on the day of the funeral that outside the church there was a lot of talking. It's not easy to get people from different parts of Haitian life to talk. And I said to myself, at least if people with so many differences can listen to each other at the funeral of Jacques Roche, perhaps his death will help. Perhaps it will make people realize they've all got a country to build.
Last week, one of Roche's kidnappers was apprehended, and he's reportedly been talking to the police, leading some to hope that perhaps this time, justice might be done in a country where gangs and governments alike have almost always wielded violence with impunity. In Port-au-Prince, I'm Michael Cavanaugh for On the Media.
A postscript. In 2003, Jacques Roche published a poem called Survival. Part of it reads, "You can gouge out my eyes and my eardrums, cut off my arms and legs, leave me naked in the street, but you cannot kill my dream. You cannot kill hope. Jacques Roche died a week before his 44th birthday.
From war to famine to AIDS, the worst of Africa manages to find its way onto the American media landscape. And so does the soft focus fodder of The Lion King and other idealized entertainment. But seldom do the dozens of countries on the continent have the power to define their own portrayals. According to James Makawa, a longtime NBC News correspondent, originally from Zimbabwe, that will soon change with the launch of the Africa Channel.
A pipeline into one of the largest untapped sources of programming anywhere on the globe.
Unlike Pan-African channels for Africans that have failed in the past, Makawa says the Africa Channel for Americans is designed specifically to combat mischaracterizations of an entire continent. I asked him how a continent with 53 countries, hundreds of languages, and vastly different cultures can be captured in a single channel.
Africa is not one monolithic, you know, place. You know, as you point out, there are many languages, many cultures. From Cape to Cairo, this is an effort to showcase a side to Africa that Americans never, ever see. The idea of just constantly having a picture on television showcasing children with flies in their eyes is just not going to cut it anymore. So will people respond to something positive out there? Absolutely. We have no doubt about that. We have travel shows that we believe are very exciting. We've also got a show called Carte Blanche, which is our version of a 60 Minutes. We will also have music shows, movies, lifestyle. We are a general entertainment network, just like a CBS would be structured.
I want to ask you about logistics. TV production is very expensive. How do you get capitalized in order to do the kind of programming that will be able to compete with, you know, the enormous variety of programming already available on American cable?
Well, the thing is, at the end of the day, you don't necessarily need $2 million to tell a story. You know, that's what the Americans do. You can still tell a compelling story without having to spend $2 million to do it. A lot of producers and a lot of writers are putting some incredible stuff together over here that they've already sunk their local money into. And it's world-class stuff, but it has just never had a home. We are going to be able to aggregate all of this incredible content and seam it into a channel where the viewer is going to come to us for an African experience.
I can see how some of it would be fascinating. Has it been fascinating to advertisers, at least hypothetically?
For the first time in television history, African advertisers will be able to afford to reach the most coveted market in the world. Until now, they have not been able to advertise on the main networks in the United States. It's just too expensive. But through us, travel companies, banks, anybody in the hospitality business, stock exchanges, I mean, I can go on and on and on. That is our advertising base, and these are some of the people that have already signed up with us and are coming to the table. But we will also be engaging American companies that do business in Africa. And there are loads of those kind of companies that are interested in coming on board with us.
All right, now, James, I want to talk to you about reality. You watch the History Channel, and you tend to see the history of crimes and violence and other lurid things. You turn on the Discovery Channel, and you also tend to see things about true crime. And you go to the Health Channel, and you see surgeries in progress and blood and gore and guts. Will there be pressure on you in doing the Africa Channel to show content that is sensational in some way that will make you as a programmer feel queasy trying to attract an audience?
Oh, you know what? Those people that do that kind of programming, they do that well. They build their audiences that way. Africa is a compelling place with so many unique stories to tell. And those stories have just never been told. We don't have to go that direction. And we won't go that direction. We don't have to conform to the lowest common denominator here. We're just coming from a totally different space with a totally different vision.
Have you licensed any soaps to run on the Africa Channel in the United States?
Yes, we have. We've got two very good soaps that we've licensed from South Africa. You know, these are soaps that will showcase Africans in a way that the West has never seen. You know, Africans are never portrayed as people who know how to love. They are never showcased as people who are in love interests or have ambitions to be successful or are showcased as people who have wealth and so on. And so what we're getting at is that the soap opera is not there just to entertain, but it's also there to educate, but also give people a sense of what is going on this part of the continent on a daily basis.
All right. Well, James, all the best of luck.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Former NBC correspondent James Makawa is the president and CEO and co-founder of the Africa Channel.
And now an update. 2 weeks ago, we spoke with Doug Clifton, the editor of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, about how his paper was feeling the chilling effect of Judith Miller's jailing. In a column, Clifton had revealed that the Plain Dealer was sitting on two stories based on leaked documents for fear that running the articles would spark an investigation that could land their reporters in jail for protecting their sources. On July 20th, a weekly alternative Cleveland paper called Scene broke one of those stories. Their report, based on a leaked FBI affidavit, revealed that the FBI was investigating former Cleveland Mayor Mike White for extortion. A second piece affirmed that this was one of the two stories that the Plain Dealer had chosen not to publish. Since the Plain Dealer's reporters were now identified with the leak, the paper decided to publish its own article about the corruption investigation. The next day, a federal judge ordered an investigation into who had leaked the documents to the two newspapers.
This week in Ukraine, media in democracy, an object lesson.
Journalist Sergei Leshenko from the widely read online newspaper Ukrainskaya Pravda asked President Viktor Yushchenko a question about his 19-year-old son's income, the BMW he drives, and the cell phone he carries, and how he supports his seemingly lavish lifestyle. A personal question, to be sure, but not unreasonable to pose to an elected official. The president and his family are public figures. The way they spend money is open to scrutiny. Yushchenko did answer, saying that his son's income from two jobs covered the expense of renting the Beamer and that his fancy cell phone was a gift from a friend. When the reporter asked on Monday where he earned his income, Mr. Yushchenko told him to, quote, act like a polite journalist and not like a hitman.
A slap in the face to the press. After supporting the Orange Revolution that put Yushchenko in office, journalists expected real press freedom, transparency, and accountability. This week, after the flap, 200 journalists got together to write a strongly worded letter. This is a shortened version.
We Ukrainian journalists are revolted by your humiliating statements towards our colleague, Sergei Leshenko, during the press conference on July 25, 2005. We reckon it is unworthy for the leader of a European democratic country to use such phrases as hired killer. And they went on, we remember your words, quote, I promise to render an account to you for my every deed. My family will render an account to you for every private action. I demand the same actions from every authority of Ukraine, unquote. According to all that, we demand a public apology for Sergei Leshenko and an account to journalists for the incomes of your family. We insist on your respect towards journalists and the constitutional right of freedom of speech and free access to information.
And President Yushchenko did offer a backhand apology in a return letter of his own. I highly value the role of the Ukrainian journalists in the victory of democratic forces during the Orange Revolution and respect the point of view which the Ukrainian mass media takes in the processes of the democratization of the country. For me, the freedom of speech and free journalists are axioms, We respect one of the major functions of the media to keep the government's actions public and under control. It is good, Yushchenko continued, that we live in a country where no topic or person is taboo for discussion. It is right that the president and his family live under the watchful eye of the press. But it is not a reason to take away my family's right to private life. I never avoid answers to the toughest of questions. The answers may seem satisfactory or not, but I am always honest with journalists. Having said that, I expect understanding and honesty in return.
Sheesh. He expects this, they demand that. Our first impulse was to wonder why the president and the press of this formerly communist nation just can't get along. Our second impulse, though, was to marvel at a press corps bold enough to demand an accounting from their president, and a president who deems it worthy to provide one.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson and Rob Christensen are engineers. We had help from Sarah Dalsimer and Josh Nathan Casis, and a magnificent return engagement from Arun Roth. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, also in the iTunes podcast directory. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org, the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Support for On the Media comes from the Lincoln Center, presenting the Mostly Mozart Festival, and the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.